Hello, this is Sun Sounds volunteer reader Keith Gamora in Flagstaff with the environment. Today we'll be reading from High Country News. Defense wants domestic terrorism out of Bundy case. A flood of drought news can reduce water use. Six bills that weaken species protections move in Congress. And in Congress, an effort to curtail national monuments. All that from www.hcn.org. And in our first story today, defense wants domestic terrorism out of Bundy case. Public debate over gun rights and extremism hangs over trial. This from Tay Wiles on October 26th. When the third in a series of trials over the 2014 Bundy Ranch standoff in Nevada gets underway, prosecutors will be able to use testimony from an expert in extremism and domestic terrorism, the judge in the case has ruled. Defense attorneys for one of the accused Bundy supporters, Ryan Payne of Montana, had sought to keep much of the federal agent's testimony out of the case, saying his expertise on militias and terrorism would prejudice the jury. Jury selection for the trial, which includes Payne, Cliven Bundy, and his sons Eamon and Ryan, begins next week. The men are facing a raft of charges related to the armed confrontation near Bunkerville, Nevada, which prevented federal agents from confiscating cattle that had been illegally grazing on public land for decades. The trial was postponed following October's mass shooting in Las Vegas, where the trial will be held. Defense also sought not to prejudice the jury on firearms, underscoring how hard attorneys are working to keep the Bundys separate in the minds of a public from a great deal of gun violence in the years since the standoff. In September, Payne's attorney motioned to limit the testimony of FBI agent Mark Saylor, including details about his expertise. Saylor, quote, was routinely asked with domestic terrorism investigations and routinely investigates militia matters, the defense said. The effect this information will have on this jury is that of believing that this is a domestic terrorism case involving militias. Domestic terrorism did not factor much into two previous trials of Bundy's supporters earlier this year. Prosecutors said explicitly that they were not trying to prove the defendants were, quote, domestic terrorists. But in a response to Payne's motion, acting U.S. Attorney Stephen Meyer wrote that Saylor's expertise would provide context and credibility to his investigation of Payne, which had begun in 2013. Quote, the government will present evidence that Payne was looking for an opportunity to have a forcible confrontation with government agents and that Bundy Ranch provided that opportunity, Meyer said. U.S. District Court Judge Gloria Navarro on Tuesday sided in part with the prosecution, ruling that the agent's expertise would be allowed in court. However, she warned prosecutors in her decision, quote, to keep any such testimony brief and limited in order to minimize any prejudice. Navarro made a similar ruling in a related trial earlier this year, though prosecutors stayed away from the topic of terrorism anyway. Todd Leventhal, a defense attorney for Scott Drexler, who was part of that case, told me that in previous trials, government witnesses briefly mentioned the 1995 Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh and referenced ISIS, both of which the defense objected to. But Payne's recent motion to exclude the topic from testimony points to the defense's desire to keep broader questions in the national conversation out of the courtroom. The trial is taking place just weeks after the deadliest mass shooting in recent U.S. history. That shooting, along with the 2016 armed takeover of Oregon's Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, also by Bundys and their supporters, may prove hard to keep out of the minds of prospective jurors. Threats of violence and mass shootings have become a major point of political contention in recent years, including questions about various applications of the Second Amendment. Following the Las Vegas shooting, the death of a counter-protester at a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, and other acts of violence throughout the country in recent years, more and more critics question why the term, quote, domestic terrorism is not more commonly used, if not in legal circles, at least in media reports. In fact, how authorities describe domestic terrorism is complicated. Nearly every agency that deals with the issue has its own definition. U.S. legal code defines domestic terrorism as an illegal act that is dangerous to human life and motivated by a desire to influence government policy. Terrorism is defined differently based on the individual's ties to any of the 60 or so groups, mostly Islamic extremists, that the State Department deems terrorist organizations. Thus, despite the horror he caused, authorities aren't using the term to describe the Vegas shooter, Stephen Paddock, who killed 58 people and himself and injured at least 500 more. Many experts say even when a perpetrator of mass violence is clearly tied to extremist beliefs, authorities are reluctant to define his actions as terrorism. For example, the term wasn't initially used to describe Joseph Stack, who flew a small plane into an Internal Revenue Service building in Texas in 2010 and left a long note about his hatred for the federal government. Dylan Roof, the white supremacist who killed 9 black churchgoers in South Carolina in 2015, didn't get the moniker either. These men were white, as are the defendants in the upcoming Bundy trial. Critics of the Bundys say this shows the defendants may be getting a break that is a part of America's cultural fabric. Muslim Americans are often more readily deemed terrorists than other Americans, says Daryl Johnson, a law enforcement consultant and former counterterrorism expert at the Department of Homeland Security. Quote, a different standard is being applied to Muslims than to other people, he told Reuters. A recent Reuters study found that in 100 federal cases, people accused of acting on behalf of Islamic State faced stronger charges than suspects of domestic terrorism. And yet the majority of terror incidents in the U.S. are perpetrated by right-wing extremists, according to 9 years of data collected by the investigative fund at the Nation Institute. As for the standoff trials, some observers argue the actions of the Bundys and their key supporters in Bunkerville should in fact be considered domestic terrorism. Errol Southers, director of the Homegrown Violent Extremism Studies Program at the University of Southern California and former member of the FBI, said the Bundys' action fit the basic definition. Anytime you have a group threatening to use violence against civilians, in this case police officers, to further their belief, they qualify to me, he said in an interview. I'm just looking at it from a definitional standpoint. When we had the Black Panther Party and the Weathermen in the 60s doing this, there was no question about what we called them. The only difference now to me is the date. Johnson sees the Bundys' actions differently, more akin to sedition than domestic terrorism. The defense attorney Leventhal says using the term for his client would have been ridiculous. Quote, why are they domestic terrorists? Because they decide to have a voice against the federal government. That's not domestic terrorism. Terrorism is going after something for a religious cause or some other cause. These guys are not domestic terrorists because they see the federal government has overstepped its bounds. In last year's primary Malheur occupation trial, the topic barely came up. I remember someone from the government saying they were never going to use that word and had no intention of doing that, defense attorney Matt Schindler said in an interview. And it would have just made the government, in another fashion, look like it was overreaching. Tay Wiles is an associate editor at High Country News and can be reached at taywiles@hcn.org. That article from Tay today. Defense wants domestic terrorism out of the Bundy case. Next up from High Country News, a flood of drought news can reduce water use. Drought-stricken California conserved more when media coverage spiked. This from Emily Benson on October 25th. You're probably familiar with the recent 5-year drought in California. That's likely due in part to the intense media attention it attracted. At the peak of the coverage, there were nearly 30 times more drought-focused newspaper stories written per month than during an earlier Golden State drought that lasted from 2007 to 2009. During the latest drought, even before California Governor Jerry Brown mandated a 25% reduction in urban water use statewide in 2015, residents of the San Francisco Bay Area were consuming less water than they had a few years earlier. Quote, the question was, what was driving them to reduce their water use, asked Nicole Sancula, the CEO and general manager of the Bay Area Water Supply and Conservation Agency, a consortium of 26 cities and water districts. New research suggests that newspapers were, in fact, part of the answer. Media attention and the public awareness and engagement that follows is one way to get people to use less water. Researchers suspected that spikes in media coverage could be driving the drops in water consumption Sankula and others were seeing. To find out, Kimberly Quesnell and Nusha Ashami of Stanford University studied a decade's worth of water use data from 2005 to 2015 from 20 of the water agencies that belong to the Bay Area Water Supply and Conservation Agency, the agency that helped fund the study. The scientists also counted the number of articles related to drought that 9 national and regional newspapers ran during the same period. There was less drought-centered coverage during the earlier drought, perhaps as a result of news coverage focused on the economic recession and the 2008 presidential election. The more recent dry spell, however, captured statewide and even national attention. The number of drought-focused articles published every month rose precipitously starting in 2014. Quote, drought in California was interesting, and it was the news of the day, says Ashami, the director of urban water policy at Stanford's Water in the West program. To elucidate the link between news stories and turning off the tap, the researchers estimated how much water households used based on combinations of factors including climate and weather parameters, demographic elements, water price, and number of drought-focused newspaper articles. Then they compared the results to average rates of actual consumption. Simulations that included the media measure more closely matched reality than those that didn't include it, suggesting that newspaper coverage was a contributor to domestic water conservation. An increase of about 100 drought stories over 2 months was associated with a drop of 11 to 18% in typical household water use. But were people actually reading the news stories? When the scientists conducted an analysis of Google search data over the same years, they found a connection between media reports and public interest in drought. Searches for the term California drought surged in the San Francisco Bay Area during the same time period that the number of newspaper stories on drought went up. Quote, for future droughts, there's no question that we learned that there is a role for media to play, Sankula says. During the recent drought, her agency and others bought ads, wrote press releases, and met with community groups and reporters to alert the public to the dire need to conserve water and to let them know how they could help by doing things like turning off sprinklers and shortening showers. And those efforts were successful. Between June 2014 and April 2017, Bay Area water agencies reduced their water use by 10 to 35%. The role that public awareness likely played in those reductions is encouraging, Ajami says. People who do care, if you give them the right set of information, they react, they respond, they change their behavior. Emily Benson is an editorial fellow at High Country News. And this story today from her, a flood of drought news can reduce water use. That article from October 25th. And also from High Country News, 6 bills that weaken species protections move in Congress. Lawmakers shift the focus to politics, not scientists, as a deciding factor in designation. This from Maya El-Kapoor on October 24th. Along with fall weather, October brought a swirl of legislation aimed at weakening the Endangered Species Act. That's not surprising. Many congressional Republicans have long made clear their disdain for the 44-year-old legislation, which many view as impeding industry. Now, with control of both houses of Congress and the White House, the Republican Party may have the political clout on Capitol Hill to fundamentally alter endangered species protection. Here are some of the key bills that have made it out of committee so far. While some proposed legislation would hamstring the ESA, weakening its power overall, other bills focus on rolling back protections for particular species or groups of species. All efforts reveal a determination to interpret the ESA as narrowly as possible by limiting the law to protecting species themselves, not critical habitats or ecosystems. It's an interpretation that could alter the landscape of the West It's also a sticking point with pro-ESA members of Congress who see habitat conservation as essential for species protection and a key part of the Act's original intent. The Federally Integrated Species Health Act, H.R. 3916, from Representative Ken Calvert, Republican from California. Most salmon are anadromous. They hatch in freshwater streams, grow up in the ocean, and return to their birth rivers to spawn. This migratory lifestyle means that two different agencies in two different departments manage the country's threatened and endangered salmon species: the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in the Department of the Interior, and the National Marine Fisheries Service in the Department of Commerce. The bill, H.R. 3916, would turn the management of salmon and similar species wholly over to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. While having one agency manage these fish sounds sensible, there are a few concerns. First, the Fish and Wildlife Service already has a backlog of candidate endangered species that it lacks time or funds to list, let alone manage, and this bill does not add any funds. Additionally, the current Department of the Interior prioritizes energy production such as hydropower over conservation. Supporters of the Federal Integrated Species Health Act include the Oregon-based Family Farm Alliance, which in a letter of support for the bill blames endangered species management and drought for falling levels of water available for agriculture. The Gray Wolf State Management Act, H.R. 424, Colin C. Peterson, Democrat from Minnesota. After trying for more than a decade, Wyoming successfully got its wolves removed from Endangered Species Act protections this past spring. Much of the state is now open to hunting wolves on site. One concern of environmental groups who sued to block the delisting was a lack of clarity about how many wolves the state will maintain. Although the state has committed to, quote, at least 10 breeding pairs and 100 wolves total, that wording is vague, and it could mean that Wyoming maintains so few wolves, the state's population risks extinction once more. Yet H.R. 424, which is sponsored by Democratic Representative Colin C. Peterson from Minnesota, would block lawsuits to reinstate federal protection, ensuring wolves remain delisted in Wyoming and the Western Great Lakes. The bill marks a shift toward greater state authority in the management of endangered species, which may also mean that the state's politics have more sway than science. Saving America's Endangered Species Act, H.R. 2603, from Representative Louis Gohmert, Republican from Texas. Not all rare species in the West evolved here. Some arrive as exotic pets, circus entertainers, hunting trophies, food delicacies, and even sources of alternative medicine. Nevada is the most paws off, with no state law regulating exotic pets and a patchwork of laws that vary at the local level. By listing nonative species, the Fish and Wildlife Service can regulate their movement to and within the United States, safeguarding everything from lion cubs to macaws while helping protect the country from introduced pathogens and invasive species. Just this month, the service and partner agencies concluded Operation Jungle Book in Los Angeles, leading to 16 convictions and rescuing more than 200 wild animals from trafficking, including a malnourished Bengal tiger and five arowana fish flown from Vietnam to Florida inside luggage. H.R. 2603 would put an end to such operations by prohibiting the listing of nonative species under the Endangered Species Act. According to Representative Gohmert, listing nonative species harms their conservation by limiting private citizens' captive breeding programs. The State, Tribal, and Local Species Transparency and Recovery Act, H.R. 1274, from Representative Dan Newhouse, Republican from Washington. This bill requires the Fish and Wildlife Service to use data submitted by a state, county, or tribal government when deciding whether or not a species is endangered or threatened. But more information isn't necessarily better in a world of nature politicized. The Endangered Species Act instructs the federal government to make listing decisions, quote, solely on the basis of the best scientific and commercial data available. Not all the data, but the best data. Objective, generally peer-reviewed, and ideally available through academic publications. For some rare species, such as the federally threatened Gila trout, State scientists are among the experts producing the best data, but forcing the agency to always use the data from local stakeholders or regional government entities who might want a certain outcome on a listing decision, as in the case of the much polarized Lesser Prairie Chicken, could skew listing results for high-stake outcomes. The Listing Reform Act, H.R. 717, from Representative Pete Olson, also a Republican from Texas. Although the ESA was written to base listing decisions on science, H.R. 717 seeks to revise the act so that the Fish and Wildlife Service considers economic impacts first, which range from private property values to the provisioning of public services such as water and power to state and local revenue streams. The bill would make the listing process even more unwieldy than it already is because listing or delisting a species, such as the grizzly bear, affects different communities in different ways. Petitions to list species as threatened would almost certainly be effectively blocked. Currently, when the agency finds a threatened species, quote, warranted but precluded for listing, that means that the species is threatened, but the agency does not have the resources to list it. Under this bill, the agency could choose not to list a species as threatened because of the anticipated economic effects of the listing. Since the bill does not specify who would identify possible economic losses at the state or local level, it's hard to say how accurate or even-handed those findings would be. Meanwhile, petitions to list species as endangered would be slowed down more than they already are, possibly forever. One common reason for Endangered Species Act lawsuits by environmental groups is because the Fish and Wildlife Service takes more than the year allowed by the Act to decide whether to list a species. This bill also allows the agency to decide, quote, as expeditiously as practicable. Yet before considering any petitions to list a species as threatened or endangered, the Fish and Wildlife Service would first have to resolve any pending petitions to remove a species from listing. The Endangered Species Litigation Reasonableness Act, H.R. 3131, from Representative Bill Huizinga, a Republican from Michigan. This bill is short and blunt. Citizens who bring suits under the ESA will have a hard time recovering attorney's fees, even if they win their cases. Currently, under the citizen suits provision of the Endangered Species Act, courts award the costs of litigation, including lawyers' fees and expert witness fees, to any party they deem appropriate. According to the National Law Review, the coverage of such legal fees can make the difference as to whether private citizens can sue so that environmental laws are followed. If this bill is passed, litigation fees, which would be awarded to the prevailing parties, would not necessarily include lawyer or court fees. When they did, reimbursement rates would be capped. Myla Kapoor is an associate editor for High Country News. Her article today: six bills that weaken species protections move in Congress. That article from October 24th. Probably have time for one more article today. This one also from High Country News. In Congress, an effort to curtail national monuments. Any monument larger than a square mile would require additional review. This from Rebecca Warby on October 18th. On October 11th, the House Natural Resources Committee approved a proposal from its chairman, Representative Bob Bishop, Republican from Utah, to overhaul the Antiquities Act. Bishop's, quote, National Monument Creation and Protection Act would severely constrain the power of the president to designate national monuments. It would limit the size of monuments a president could designate, as well as the kinds of places protected. The 1906 Antiquities Act allows a president to act swiftly to protect federal lands facing imminent threats without legislation getting bogged down in Congress. Many popular areas, including Zion, Bryce, and Arches National Parks in Bishop's home state, were first protected this way. Under Bishop's legislation, any proposal for a monument larger than 640 acres, one square mile, would be subject to a review process. Areas up to 10,000 acres would be subject to review under the National Environmental Policy Act, while those between 10,000 and 85,000 acres would require approval from state and local government. The bill would allow emergency declarations, but they would expire after a year without congressional approval. It would also codify the president's power to modify monuments, a power that has been contested in light of the Interior Department's recent recommendations that President Donald Trump reduce the size of several monuments, including Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante in Utah. Originally established to protect archaeological sites from vandalism and looting, the Antiquities Act has since been used to protect a broad range of areas for a broad range of purposes. For example, President Bill Clinton designated Cascade Siskiyou National Monument in Oregon to preserve biodiversity. By contrast, Hanford Reach, the first national monument managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, not only preserves a sweeping desert landscape, but also holds remnants of atomic history, including plutonium reactors, in the process of being dismantled. Bishop's bill, however, would prohibit new landscape-scale monuments by replacing the phrase, quote, historic landmarks, historic and prehistoric structures, and other objects of historic or scientific interest, with the more restrictive object or objects of antiquity. That term, the bill further specifies, does not include natural geographic features. Bishop maintains that these changes would restore the act to its original intent. Any honest reading reveals that it was created to protect landmarks, structures, and objects, he wrote in an op-ed for the Washington Examiner, not vast swaths of land. President Theodore Roosevelt, who signed the act into law and designated the Grand Canyon as a national monument in 1908, did not feel that way. Though the Grand Canyon was, of course, later turned into a treasured park, its designation spurred the first of many battles in Congress over the size of monuments designated under the act, which stipulates that they should be the smallest area compatible with protection. Two of those tussles limited the power of the president under the Antiquities Act. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt declared Jackson Hole a monument in 1943. A 1950 law made the monument part of Grand Teton National Park and added an amendment to the Antiquities Act stating that all future monument designations in Wyoming must go through Congress. President Jimmy Carter's creation of a 56 million acres of monuments in Alaska led to an act that requires congressional approval for monuments larger than 5,000 acres in that state. And we will pause this article here as we are just about out of time for today. This has been your Sun Sounds volunteer reader, Keith Gamora. Thanks for listening. Join us here each weekend at this time for more of The Environment.